Welcome to The Art Career, a space breaking barriers by letting you sit in on candid, straightforward conversations with leading art professionals in visual arts, writing, music, theater, and film. I'm your host, Emily McElreath, and I invite you to join me for inspirational conversations with icons of our generation. We dive deep into topics like self-development, career trajectories, mental health, social justice, and the artists that have changed our lives. With each episode, our mission is to empower you, expanding your journey through the arts. Join us for new episodes every Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts. The Art Career is thrilled to announce its partnership with Glimpse. Glimpse Guides are a collection of luxury guidebooks with an outstanding social mission we are proud to support. Featuring the best of hotels, restaurants, activities, and itineraries for each featured city, Glimpse Guides also include recommendations and travel tips by a curated selection of tastemakers. The most exciting part of Glimpse Guides is 100% of their profits go to Give a Glimpse, which provides funding for educational travel scholarships for underserved students. What is better than that? Glimpse believe that travel is the most important form of education, and it is their mission to send as many deserving students abroad as possible. Glimpse also offers luxury trip design services with VIP perks like early check-in, room upgrades, restaurant and spa credits, welcome gifts, and more. Glimpse has quickly become our one and only travel planner. Go check them out at glimpseguides.com and tell founder Jordan Rhodes that the Art Career Podcast sent you. Damian Davis is a Brooklyn-based artist born in Louisiana and raised in Arizona. His practice explores historical representations of Blackness by seeking to unpack the visual language of various cultures and question how these societies code and decode representations of race through craft, design, and digital modes of production. His work has appeared at the Whitney Museum and the Museum of Modern Art, as well as Method Gallery in Seattle. He is the recipient of the Rema Hortman Foundation Community Engagement Grant and has been awarded residencies with the Museum of Arts and Design, Lower Manhattan Cultural Council, and Pilchuck Glass School. Mr. Davis is also a former fellow and current advisor for the Art and Law Program in New York City. His work has been mentioned in the New York Times, Freeze Magazine, The Guardian, Hyperallergic, and Vulture Magazine. Mr. Davis holds a BFA in Studio Art and an MA in Visual Arts Administration from New York University.
Hi, Damian. How are you this afternoon?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm wonderful. We're revving up for season 4 of The Art Career, and I'm sure you know this because Jasmine was, I think, introduced us initially, but Jasmine Wahi and Rebecca, who just had another little baby, are just such wonderful cheerleaders of yours. And listen, I was blown away when I visited Project for Empty Space and saw all the amazing things, because I didn't know fully what was going on in Newark until Rebecca and Jasmine and Project for Empty Space. And Damian, are you in Brooklyn as well?
I was for 16 years.
And where are you now?
So I moved to Washington Heights, and I've been there for the last year to be closer to a previous job. But now I'm actually making the move to Newark. So next month, I'm going to be living in Newark, New Jersey.
It's so impressive what's happening, and I can't imagine a more vibrant and exciting space to be moving to. That's awesome.
It really is. You know, there's a special kind of magic here in Newark. The art community is really thriving. And the thing that I love about the art community here in Newark is that not only is everyone really into like making and the sort of physical aspects of being an artist, but a lot of people here are really into like social engagement, political engagement, activism and stuff, which is all in line with what I want to be doing with my work. So it feels really good to be here.
Yeah, to find a community within a community that really serves us is one of the luckiest things we can find in life, I feel like. I've recently experienced that. So yeah, that's exciting for you. All right, let's back up. Where were you born?
Born in Crowley, Louisiana. So like sort of western central Louisiana, swampland, all that stuff.
And take me through your life in 3 to 4 minutes in terms of you were born in Louisiana and how did you eventually make your way up to New York?
Yeah. So born in Louisiana when I was 3, I think. We moved to Massachusetts. My father had gotten a job transfer there. One of the things I probably should say, because it sort of explains that early trajectory of my life, is that I had an older brother. He was born with sickle cell. Both of my parents didn't know that they carried the sickle cell trait when they had my brother, and found out that they carried the trait when they found out my brother had sickle cell. So when, it's actually funny because my mom was like apparently literally on her way to get her tubes tied when she found out she was pregnant with me.
Wow.
And my brother and I were both C-section. So my mom was like, oh, I think it'll be easier to remember your birthday if I just add a 1 to each number in your brother's birthday. So I'm literally a year, a month, and a day.
Wow.
Younger than my brother. But when we moved to Massachusetts, because of his sickle cell, every winter that we were there, he would get pneumonia and like almost die. So my dad asked for a transfer to a place with a more temperate climate. And that's how we wound up living in Phoenix, Arizona. Okay. So I spent like most of my childhood growing up in Phoenix. The thing I joke about is I was born in the swamp and raised in the desert. And I wound up coming here to New York for college. I came at 17 to go to NYU for art school. And then art school happened, for better or worse. And then I got a job and went to grad school. And I'm still here.
Yes, you are. And I feel like the past, it's always tricky when someone's like, the past 2 years have been really exciting for you, because you're like, no, actually, I've been doing all of this for a really long time and I've been on my radar, you know, but you sure are on the radar of the art world recently, and it's so well deserved. And I deeply respect your artwork. It was really awesome to be able to walk through that show at Project for Empty Space with Rebecca. It's like, who better to do that, you know? And then later, Jasmine reached out to me and suggested I interview you. So it's full circle. This is probably almost 6 to 9 months later, we're finally sitting down. You know, I've done my homework. I've read all of your interviews recently. What's been the most exciting part of your career trajectory in the past couple years for you?
Wow. It's almost a tough one. I think that there's been these like kind of individual victories that I've had recently that feel really good. one of the things that has always been important for me as an artist is to not necessarily stay stagnant. Like, I like trying different things. I like making different kinds of work in different ways. So a couple of years ago, I had a solid year. I had a solo show that was pretty well received. I started curating, weirdly.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, that was just like a thing that just sort of randomly happened. It wasn't like in the plan for me.
But you curated several shows. I mean, you're a solid curator at this point.
Oh my God, don't say that. I guess I've curated exhibitions now, which feels good, I guess. I hope. Yeah, it's a good thing.
What's the hesitancy with that? What is that?
You know what it is that for me, I really love taking on different kinds of challenges and different kinds of projects and doing things that make me uncomfortable. Curating was an interesting adventure only because I kind of got to see firsthand how weird people get when some arbitrary title gets attached to you. And that was sort of a new experience because I think I had been used to, up until that point, kind of moving in silence and moving in whatever direction mm-hmm. felt right for me. And then all of a sudden I had this like curator title next to my name. And then people started kind of like acting funny. and funny in the sense that it was like, you know, all of a sudden there were all these like opinions about what I should be doing, or shouldn't be doing, or who I should be showing or not showing. And I've probably been the kind of artist that doesn't do well when other people sort of volunteer their opinion for things. I don't really like letting in other voices when it comes to the work that I'm doing, the creative work that I'm doing. So it was kind of a tough thing to handle, or at least that aspect of the job was a tough thing to handle. Like, people that I had known for a very long time, their energy just kind of like switching up in this weird way. But I think it also just sort of comes from, and this is the thing I've talked about with my friends, like, you know, the art world in other parts of the world, I think that other places have an easier time recognizing and reconciling that artists are multifaceted people that like doing lots of different things. So like in Europe or, you know, South America, whatever, you can be an artist and a curator and a writer and all these other things. And here in the United States, I think that people feel like, okay, if he's a curator now, he must not want to be an artist anymore. And that was a tough thing for me to deal with, having to sort of combat this like weird public perception that I didn't want to make work.
Why are we like that? It's so true what you're saying. There is that stigma attached to it.
I think it has to do with power. I think that people hear the word curator and they assume that there's all this power that comes from it, which is true in certain ways. I mean, if you're attached to an institution, then, you know, you're making decisions, you're influencing culture, all that kind of stuff. I guess I've always just felt like in this sort of ecosystem that we're in, artists are the most powerful thing. So to kind of be confronted with these attitudes or beliefs that I'm somehow more powerful because I'm a curator never really made sense to me. If anything, I felt like I had less power because now I had to be like mindful of how I moved and how I talked to people and how I sort of present information. Whereas before it was kind of like, hey, I'm just another dumb artist with some ideas. Like, let's go, you know, let's do whatever. But so it was an amazing experience. Don't get me wrong. I learned a lot about myself and about the work that I want to make as an artist and the types of work and types of artists I want to champion as an advocate. But the museum world is also just like really insane and toxic. And, you know, everyone's like overworked and overextended and underthanked. So
that's for sure. And that's something that we haven't really made. I mean, I guess we've made a little dent in it, but not really. I mean, it's that's kind of a loaded statement that I just made, but I hear you with that totally.
But I think it's true. You know, I also teach. So for me, I find myself constantly saying these things to the students about, like, you know, unburdening yourself and taking the risk and all this stuff. And I've noticed the more, or the deeper I get into this whole universe of, like, being an artist, the more I realize that there's so much conservatism within the art world, like conservatism in the way people sort of appreciate themselves, conservatism in the way they're able to, like, recognize how expansive another person's practice can be or should be. And that is maybe a thing that I am struggling with right now. Just this realization that it's not as easy to be free in art as I would like to think that it should be.
Because it's art, and that's, you know, where we go with that, and it's just not the case a lot of the time.
Yeah, and for me, I feel like art is the thing that sets us free. I know that sounds really corny.
No, it doesn't. It's very true.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing that I use to find myself or figure myself out or work through my own stuff. I hope that other artists are looking at it that way too. I mean, some people might just be in it for the money, whatever. But I think that making something, like building an intelligence into your hands to make something, researching, but also recognizing that everything around you can exist as research, and then using that to make something new or make something that helps you figure out yourself, that maybe then helps other people figure out themselves or figure out you or figure out each other. Like, that's kind of like a magic thing that doesn't exist just anywhere. And
for sure. And, you know, I think back to what your schooling was in, I think this freedom when we arm ourselves with certain knowledge, grants, fundraising, advocacy, marketing, you know, all of these things that you say, you know, a traditional art school does not teach us. And I think this, you know, concept of an artist being free, I think that artists will only be totally free when they are armed with those tools as well. That's, like, really why I started doing this type of work in the first place, because I was like, whoa, what's going on here? You know, there's all this talent, and the majority of these artists don't understand that they're a business and they're entrepreneurs, and they have to market themselves, and they have to learn how to write a grant, you know, all those things. So I'm pivoting a little, but not really, because I think that all of those things shape our freedom as artists.
No, absolutely. And I guess I have to say, I don't think I would be able to slip into these other roles as easily as I have been were it not this other training that I got. So the background story is I went to NYU to get my BFA in studio art. Did not like the experience at all. I mean, I met some really incredible people, some really beautiful, wonderful, like, tragic people. But in terms of the education, like the quality of the education, it was not what it should have been. And I also don't think that I fully understood how poor of an education, an art education, it was until many years after it was over. And a lot of it had to do with just sort of omission, you know, like, as a Black queer person, I was never really seeing myself reflected in the artists that were being taught to me. I was not able to get substantive feedback because I was the only one of either of those categories in the room typically. So, you know, the work definitely developed in a way that was about kind of learning how to engage or navigate or maybe even trick people that aren't used to or interested in talking about things that are central to my experience. But also art school, like, made me quit being an artist.
Right.
Yeah, like, literally.
You're not the only one, you know?
It's crazy. You know, I spent 10 years thinking that I didn't have what it took to be successful at this. And it wasn't until after I had finished my master's degree. So basically, I went to NYU senior year of undergrad. Like, we couldn't afford it, so I had to basically drop out. I wound up getting a job in the administrative office in the art department at NYU, which gave me the tuition remission to finish my undergrad. And then I was like, well, let me get a master's degree. I thought I didn't have what it took to be an artist, but I wanted to stay in the arts. So I was like, well, let me get a degree in visual arts administration, like grant writing, marketing, fundraising, strategic planning, like all these things that art school doesn't teach you, but, you know, is actually super useful. It's really super useful to be in a room talking or having critical discussions and conversations about the role of museums, what their responsibility is to the public, like, how do galleries function? How do they make their money? How do they potentially, like, swindle artists?
No one knows these things.
Yeah, no one, you know, it's all just trial and error. It's all just learning by experience. So unless you're fortunate enough to, you know, kind of gain entry via these gatekeepers into this world, and they like you enough to sort of train you or teach you, or maybe sometimes do for you, which means they're actually withholding information from you in a lot of ways.
I love that statement. That's so true.
Yeah. It's like, you know, there's little to no interest in teaching artists how to run their own studio on the administrative side successfully. You know, my whole thing is artists are at the center of this ecosystem. We're the ones that are, like, you know, making the stuff, like, trying to push culture forward. And then you have all these other things that are, you know, out on the periphery. And the thing that I say to artists all the time is, like, number one, remember that you're at the center of this ecosystem. But also, number two, remember that the further out in this ecosystem you move, the more invested those folks are in gaslighting you as the artist into thinking that you're not important, because that's how they manipulate you. Because if you as the artist don't recognize that, like, you're the one putting on the museum exhibition, you're the one putting on the gallery show, yeah, you're the one, like,
you're done
producing the thing that people are coming to see, it makes it easy for someone to make you feel like, you know, you're disposable, that you're replaceable, that, you know, you're an inconvenience, that you should be thankful for whatever you get. Like, that's that toxic stuff that ends up, you know, burning people out and driving people out of this field.
The Art Career is thrilled to announce its sponsorship from the New York Studio School for Season 4. Founded in 1964 as an intensive studio arts program with an emphasis on perception, artists learning from artists, and drawing as the most direct means of describing one's ideas or experiences, the Studio School offers an array of full-time and part-time programs that prioritize small classes and individual guidance from dedicated instructors distinguished in their fields. It is located in the heart of Greenwich Village in a National Historic Landmark building that was once home to the original Whitney Museum of American Art. The school invites you to join its free public programming, including the evening lecture series, which for more than half a century has been a cornerstone of the New York City art world and can now be experienced worldwide via live streaming. Visit nyss.org to enroll in classes, see what's on in the gallery, register for evening classes, and more. To learn more about full-time study at New York Studio School, schedule an in-person tour or a virtual meeting by emailing info@newyorkstudioschool.org.
When you were in your undergraduate studies and you felt as though you didn't have what it took to be an artist, which we know that is, like, the farthest thing from the truth, do you think there were select individuals, we're not going to name names, but was it people? right? Specific people really making you believe that? Or do you think it was just a result of the system and what was happening in that moment for you in New York in school?
I would probably identify three things. I think there's a larger overarching system that's deeply flawed that has to be sort of pointed out. I think there are individual people that actively or subconsciously contribute to that. And then there are the people that are just like willfully ignorant and unwilling to sort of question or challenge why things are the way that they are and recognize that there might be a need to change those things. So it's a system, it's the people actively supporting the system, and then there's the people passively like letting the system continue because they don't want to do the work of like questioning what's going on. So there's definitely individual people that I could point out. If those people are listening, they know exactly who they are.
Yeah,
I don't have any hesitation when it comes to like telling people like, hey, I think you're a racist. You know, things like that. But, there were definitely things that I witnessed or things that happened to me specifically that I still point to. You know, I remember like when I was working at NYU, I had a supervisor like hand me a pack of Kool-Aid for Christmas. You know, this same person also like went around the building, the art building, like ripping down posters that students were making, like calling into question the lack of diversity among the faculty and staff. I remember being a sophomore in college and the teacher emailing us asking for feedback for the class. And I, you know, said, I was like, you didn't show us any people of color the whole semester. Like you didn't show any black people. And then he very defensively sent an email back of a list of black artists that he had obviously Googled and basically told me to do my own research. And that's kind of just like the tip of the iceberg. So there were a lot of things in my undergrad experience at NYU that were not healthy. And I was also like repeatedly made to feel like I was the problem for thinking that these were messed up things. So
yeah, it's the definition of gaslighting, like you said. I mean, that's and what we do with that, you know, once you believed that or believed it a half of it, whatever it is, it's then clawing yourself out of that belief. And you know, I don't, with gaslighting at large, I don't know if we ever fully, when it happens for a long period of time, I don't know if we ever fully come out of it. But okay, so then you go, you do your master's and then you graduate and you're like, I miss making art and I want to make art.
Yeah. I think the realization after going through that master's program was that I didn't have to wait for a gatekeeper to teach me these things anymore. I knew how to do them myself. So,
Isn't that a wonderful realization?
It's really incredible to, you know, I think coming out of undergrad, like no one really talked to us about residencies. No one talked to us about grants. No one talked to us about like doing a lot of the really basic stuff that you're supposed to be doing when you come out of school. I think that I think I had as instructor senior year hand us a packet on how to write a CV and was like, here you go. But there was never any even like discussion on how to do it or an expectation of doing it as an assignment. You know, it was very much just like, you're on your own, good luck, figure it out. But I also don't think that, you know, it's very possible that some of that information was being delivered to other students and not to me. You know, I definitely remember also like right after undergrad seeing some of my peers get a lot of attention and support from faculty. And, you know, I was not one of those people. So I also really had to find my tribe outside of that place. And that wasn't necessarily an easy thing. I think that once I learned how to do a lot of this other back end stuff, this behind the scenes stuff for myself, it became easier to kind of control the narrative around my own work, to control like where the work is going and apply for things. And I guess that's why I kind of do this thing where I don't like letting other voices in, because
I was just going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like all the parts of my career that have been good or successful have been things that I figured out on my own. You know, I've gone through periods where, you know, I've let friends, like really competent, successful people say like, hey, I'm going to help you write your applications for residencies and stuff. And like, I would like kind of let them do that and still not get anything. And, you know, 1 year I was like, I'm just going to try and do these on my own the way that I think that they should be done. And I wound up getting everything that I applied for that year, which was a whole other problem. But I'm just a huge advocate for people learning this stuff themselves. And it's a conversation that I, some of my friends will say annoyingly, am constantly trying to have with other artists.
Yeah, but you know it to be true from your own experience. And when we have that, it's, you know, I don't know. Once you figure out there, you are the only gatekeeper, right? And there's no one else there. I mean, that's something that people have thought I've been delusional in the past, but I'm like, oh no, I'm just going to like do this, or I'm just going to reach out to that person, or I'm just going to try for this. And they're like, well, kind of like, well, who told you could try for that? And I'm like, no one, right? And that's hard for people. They think there's a bit, especially in the art world, it's so exclusive and ridiculous that people think there are these like barriers, which there are. And I'm not comparing my experience to your experience whatsoever. I'm saying like to understand that we have the freedom and the power to do all of that on our own and arm ourselves with the knowledge that you're talking about. And you're not going to obtain that knowledge unless you actually go for it and write the application or do the grant yourself, right? Like, what did you say before? When someone does something for you, it takes away, I forgot how you said it. You said it so beautifully.
Well, it's like a withholding thing, you know, it performing the act for someone, depending on the act, can be a withholding kind of action. So if I don't teach you how to write your own artist statement, if I don't teach you how to, you know, fill out an application, you're going to be relying on me to do it. And if you're relying on me to help you apply to residencies, help you like fill out grant applications, then you're probably only going to be able to do the ones that I think you should be doing, you know, versus treading your own path. It's an interesting problem that's kind of, in my opinion, born out of multiple institutions that are kind of wildly disinterested in moving themselves forward, or even turning like a sort of critical eye back towards themselves. So like art school, for example, it's like, you know, we're still operating within the same model that's existed since like the 60s, right? It hasn't really changed that much since the 60s, but the number of people going to art school has changed. Education, higher education in this country has changed. Access to education has changed. Like, so I don't, it's to me, the resources have changed. Like even just from when I was in undergrad, like, you know, now kid, and this is the thing that always kills me. It's like, you know, kids in art school have a whole supercomputer in their pocket that they can use to pull up information whenever they want. And they don't do it because they think that, you know, it's like some authority figure, the teacher, is the one who's supposed to be delivering the information, that they can't just go out and actively find some of this information themselves. And I had to say in my class this week, it was like, if anything that I'm telling you is stuff that you can find on YouTube or Google, I'm not doing my job correctly. Because at this point, a lot of this information you can just go search for. So it's my job to be looking at, you know, the totality of you as a person, like you as a whole person, as an artist, and then taking all the information that I'm able to get just by being another human being standing in front of you and give you like some critical feedback about that.
Some subjective feedback.
Yeah. Like, you know, I can show you how to use a drill. I can show you how to use a bandsaw, but is that really the best use of like our time right now? I don't know. I have an opinion, but yeah, I struggle with it, especially as a teacher in an art school. I feel like I'm constantly saying like, this will probably get me fired, but I think this, I think you should be knowing about this. I think you should be reading the news, like art news. I think that you should know how to read a consignment agreement. Even that's like a wild experience for me as a teacher to be like, here's a consignment agreement.
But it shouldn't be. Like, that's so important to understand.
Yeah. And it's an amazingly kind of interesting, powerful thing to watch a young person. Like, you know, we just throw the consignment agreement up on the screen. Everyone's reading through it. And then you start to see the gears turn. And it's like, wait. But this says here that they can do this with my work. And I'm like, yeah. And they're like, but if this thing happens, then this other really bad thing is going to happen.
You're
just
like,
to
yes.
me.
That's
and I'm like,
correct.
Yes. And they're like, but this seems really bad and wrong. And people just sign this. And I'm like, yeah.
Yes.
Because they don't need it.
Because they're so lucky to have that opportunity, right? And that's what we're conditioned. Oh my God, thank you so much for this opportunity. Of course I'll sign, you know? Mm-hmm. And I mean, I work with so many artists and it's like, it's so difficult to watch that on a daily basis.
And your heart just kind of breaks because, you know, for most of them, they just don't know. They don't know that there's, you know, predatory people taking advantage of them. They don't understand that the art world, especially in New York, is largely unregulated. It's people just doing whatever they think they can get away with. It's difficult. And, you know, I feel like we release a lot of these kids that go to art school into the world, like, wildly unprepared.
Yeah, and in a capitalistic society where, you know, when you're at the bottom of that, you know, space in which, like, you don't have money coming out of school and you don't have the power that comes with making money, right? You are more likely to sign the dotted line, you know, and that's something that's like, we can unpack that. That's a whole nother, I mean, that's like a whole nother conversation, but it's difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, to your point, there's that whole sort of feast or famine thing that happens mm-hmm. when you come out of art school. It's like, if I'm not like super mega rich selling my work for $40,000 a pop, or if I'm not starving, then I'm not really, I'm not really an artist, you know? And for me, I feel like it's a very simple question. It's just like, you know, what for you as an artist would a self-sustaining practice look like? You know, how much do you need to make to pay the rent for your studio? How much do you need to make to get the materials that you need to continue making your work? Like, you know, once we kind of move away from this, like, oh, I have to be suffering to be an artist, or I have to get all this external validation and success, quote unquote, success to be an artist. Like, it's not, I'm not doing it right. When doing it right could just be setting yourself up to be able to keep doing it.
Do you care about external validation?
Like
I do, I'm going to be honest, you know, I still do. And I, you know, fight against that all the time. So I think that's a,
yeah, it is a thing that I am working away from or trying to work away from. I think that, I spent a lot of my life, my childhood, especially, just sort of like deathly afraid of what other people thought of me, or what other people thought I was. And that was largely just by virtue of existing in this body that's politicized in all these ways that I don't have control over. But then also having or possessing like a queer identity that, you know, in certain places and spaces and times put me in just like precarious positions. So having to worry about what people think is maybe just kind of like baked into queerness in all these ways, or just having to be cognizant of how other people are thinking is something that I've had to worry about. But professionally, in terms of my art career, I'm probably less interested in what other people think than I've ever been before. And that feels really good and freeing. But I think a lot of it also has to do with just receiving. And this is me being super honest. It's like, it's easier to be like, oh, I don't care about this after you've already gotten it, right? So, you know, I've gotten and been fortunate enough to get lots of institutional support from museums, you know, other spaces, things like that. So I don't necessarily think that I have anything to prove anymore when it comes to that, because I've just kind of done that. I recognize that it's much easier to say that after the fact. So, sure. You know, before that, I was very much like, yeah, I have to prove that I can make big work. I have to prove that I can sell out a booth at an art fair. I have to prove that I can like do a solo booth at an art fair, you know, it was like all those kinds of things. And you eventually maybe like hit enough of these benchmarks where you're able to kind of say to yourself, like, actually I'm okay. I don't have to prove as much to other people as I used to. I think it's more about proving things to myself. So, and there's probably like a slew of things that would spiral the conversation in tons of different directions, but yeah.
For sure. And I think like on the flip side, is there a small element of external validation that's like okay to want, you know, like it's a fine line and there's, you know, so it's not necessarily, I don't think we're sitting here being like, you know, that is horrible to want external validation, you know, it's not, but it's when that is your only driving factor. And we've all had to check ourselves, throughout the course of my career.
I would agree with that. I think that it's hard not to, as an artist, want some kind of external validation, because especially if you went to art school, everything is kind of set up for you to get that. Like critique, like the whole structure of critique is about you seeking feedback from your peers. So it's, I think, natural to want to get at least validation from your peers in the art world, to know that the people that you believe in also believe in you. I think that that's healthy. I also very strongly believe in competition when it comes to art, and not in like a toxic way, but I've definitely got certain art friends and we know this about each other. It's like, oh, that bitch got that fucking opportunity. And I got to step my stuff up. Like I got to work a little bit harder because I need to keep.
Yeah. And as long as that's not toxic, like that is, it's, there's nothing wrong with me wanting to be the best. Right. Like I do. I want to be the best in many things I do, not all the things I do, but I think that's what drives, I mean, I think that's what lights the fire under our ass. And I think that saying, hey, that bitch got that fucking opportunity, I want that opportunity, is a lot different from that bitch got that opportunity and I wish she hadn't gotten that opportunity, right? You're talking about two totally different things. One is healthy and the other is just like super toxic. But yeah, I'm constantly being like, oh, that person just did that. Fuck, I gotta do that. Like, what do you mean this exists? Like, what do you mean you got this? And there can even be like, I know that I've done more than this person and this person got that opportunity, you know, but it's still, you have to check yourself when you're like, I don't want that person to have that opportunity. So it's,
once it turns into like, oh, I hate this person or something like that, then that's not good. But
Because all that's ever doing is taking power away from you. It's like not even worth going there.
Exactly. But I think that, and you brought up a good point where this whole like, well, I've accomplished these things, I should be able to get this too. And I am a huge advocate or proponent of like taking personal inventory. Like, it's very important to just step back and say like, well, I've done XYZ. You know, there's all these other things that I want to do. Absolutely. But it's very important that I step back or step outside of myself and recognize that I've already accomplished a lot of things that other people haven't been able to. And it's not even specific to me. It's like, you know, you could literally just get out of bed in the morning and you've already accomplished more than some other people are able to. That's just the reality of it. So, you know, being able to accomplish anything should feel like a gift or a blessing.
Yes, it should. And for someone like me, you know, with my white privilege, right, that's always something. It's like, oh, yeah, like, actually, I'm not taking away from my hard work at all. But that's something that was a hell of a lot easier for me to accomplish than a lot of other people. So it's, you know, it's layered, obviously. And it's, but no matter what lens you're looking at it through, like you said, it's just important to be able to take that personal inventory, you know, like whatever that means, and be like, okay, I did do this, this, and this. Okay, you know, for me, maybe this was easier for me to get done than a lot of other people. And so how can I give back in that way and then continue to move my career forward, right? Because I'm not going to stop because I have been given certain things, but you need to level that out with giving back. Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. And just to kind of go back on that privilege thing, I think part of that inventory is recognizing that we all, you know, possess certain privileges, or, you know, there's certain things that might be a disadvantage to us. Like, you know, I might be Black and I might be queer, but I'm also a man. I'm cis, you know, able-bodied. Like, you know, there's all these things that might give me privileges over other people, and it's important for me to recognize that. I think once we get into the habit of just like recognizing that we all like possess power and privileges, different circumstances and different scenarios, then we all can become accustomed to like wielding whatever power we have in support of other people at any given time.
For sure. When did you come out?
Oh God. College, freshman year of college, I guess. Yeah.
Anything you want to share about that experience or no?
I mean, there was no like parade. There was no big announcement. I think it was more just like me learning to be more comfortable with myself as time went on, and maybe learning to be open about who I am early on. So it's a thing that I tried as like kind of work into early conversations with people who, for whatever reason, can't like recognize that I'm a flaming homosexual. So, you know, yeah, there was no like big thing, I think. But I also feel like that's a good thing in a way. You know, this younger generation of queer people, it's a very different thing for them, just sort of navigating all of it. You know, there's so many more resources, there's so many more things that they have access to than my generation did. But I think there's all these things that they don't have access to, right? It's like, you know, Grindr comes along, so they hook up online, which means they're not like learning to interact with other people and hook up like at a club. But because apps like Grindr might give them access to sex in this immediate way, they're not getting all the other things that might come from looking for sex in those spaces, right? Friendships, intergenerational relationships with other queer people, like stuff like that. So, you know, I recognize that there's good and bad for each generation. And for them, like they're sort of articulating and defining queerness for them in a way that's radically different than it was for me. And that's maybe the beauty of queerness, is that we're constantly evolving and changing and morphing into new things. So
I think that that's a funny thing you said about, like when I came out, I was in high school, but there was no, it was never, I'm always like, yeah, it kind of just gradually happened. And I never really, there wasn't, I think people outside of the queer community think it's like an event. And sometimes it is, right? Like oftentimes it is, but a lot of the time it's just a never ending evolving and learning about ourselves as queer human beings. And that's something that, like, I look back in high school and I was the kid who was like, it was in your face. I was like, I'm going to date this girl and I don't care what you think. And this is what's going to happen because I'm bad and I'm different. And that was my identity of this just like sensationalist fucking, I think a lot of teenagers are like that. But, you know, it's, and then when I realized that that was, you know, that my queerness has nothing to do with shock value, you know, like how much that was doing a disservice to myself by acting in that way. And back to what you said about this generation, I think, yeah, it's just different, but it's cool for us to learn, you know, through the generation. I'm like, oh God, I wish I knew that. Or like, I wish I was comfortable with that. Or like you said, like, oh gosh, I feel really bad for you that you're only making these connections through these like trashy apps, you know, and you're not like talking to people. I mean, yeah, so it's just, it's interesting. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's funny because I sort of see it. It's like with any other sort of civil rights movement or advancement, it's like you work so hard so the next generation is like a little bit less burdened than you were. But I feel like there's always this, now that I'm older, I think that there's like this generational thing where it's like, we work so fucking hard for you to be unburdened. How dare you act unburdened now? You know, this whole idea that like,
I've dated younger people before, and it's been exact, like, who do you think you are? You have no idea what I've done for you. And that's so funny because I have been in that exact situation and sounding like that. And it's just horrible.
The doors we've opened.
You should be so thankful to me that you are so comfortable right now. What the fuck is that?
Yeah, but it's kind of beautiful, right? It's like, you know, we get to be the crotchety old queers who are like, how dare you be so free?
Yeah, I dated a trans man and he was like, I'd be like, how dare you tell me? Because he'd be like, well, you, Emily, you actually like don't understand this, this, and this. And that was really insulting what you just said. You don't know what you're talking about. And I was like, me? I was the first queer woman to come out in my town, which I was. But like, all of a sudden you get into that crotchety old queer. We're crotchety old queer people. And it's true.
But it's okay. You know,
okay.
I think
it's gonna have to be.
Yeah, you know, I think that's just the beauty of getting older, is you learn to recognize that being older means you've gone through a lot of shit. It's like when you hit the age that your parents were when they had you, it's like, oh, I'm so sorry for expecting what I expected from you.
Yeah, because I know nothing right now, and you had me. Yeah. All right. So is there anything coming up that you, this has been, I can't believe it's almost been an hour. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I've kind of gotten lost in it.
As someone extremely passionate about mental health, seeing a therapist is essential to my quality of life. We'd like to take this moment to announce how thrilled we are to partner with the world's largest therapy service, BetterHelp. If you think you might be feeling anxious, depressed, or even just overwhelmed, being alone with your thoughts can be an isolating feeling. BetterHelp is customized online therapy that offers video, phone, and even live chat sessions with your therapist. So you don't even have to see anyone on camera if you don't want to. You just fill out a questionnaire to help assess your specific needs, and then you get matched with a therapist in under 48 hours. It's that easy. Join the 2 million plus people who have taken charge of their mental health with an experienced BetterHelp therapist. And just for the Art Career podcast listeners, we will offer 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/TAC. That's better, BETTER, help, HELP.com/TAC. Thanks again to BetterHelp for sponsoring the Art Career podcast.
Is there anything you'd like to talk about that we haven't touched upon? Anything you'd like to promote that's coming up?
There's definitely things. I think they're mostly things that I can't really talk about yet because they're still in formation. But I am going to be in a group show next year, which is kind of unusual for me to get this much notice to be in a group show. But I think because of the venue, it has to be that because it's at the Met. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, which is
I don't know if anyone's ever heard of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's not really that big of a deal. I don't know really why you're
really not. Like maybe you've heard of it, but I guess it also goes back to that. Like, yeah, I don't really feel like I have anything to prove anymore. It's like I'm getting to be in shows like at the Met. It's fine. I'm good. You know.
Yeah.
I think I'm doing okay at this art thing for now.
That's going to be in 2024, correct?
Yeah. So November of 24, that show's going to open. The same month I turned 40, which is kind of wild. Like, oh,
God,
yeah.
You're still so young.
God bless you.
You are. I'm going to be 43 in a couple weeks. And, like, you're a fetus, Damien.
I'll take that. I've earned that. You know, whatever. But yeah, no, it's
cool. It's the same month you turn 40.
Yeah, it's gonna be a nice month, I think, where I can maybe just step back and look at all the like bad shit that I've been through and say, like, I'm here. Still doing this.
Standing on the steps of the Met in the November you turn 40. With your work in the institution that you're standing in front of doesn't suck.
It's cute, you know. I'll take it.
It's amazing. I could talk to you for hours, and I look forward to being in each other's circles and staying in touch now. So many people that deeply care about your career, I hold in such high regard. So I'm really looking forward to watching what you do next and hopefully meeting in person really soon, certainly before November 24. All right, Damien, this was really fun. I can't thank you enough. And I'm thrilled to have you on season 4 of the Art Career.
Well, thank you so much for having me. This has been a real treat.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of The Art Career. If you get value from this podcast, please consider helping me make more of these episodes by becoming an Art Career Premium member at theartcareer.supercast.com. That's theartcareer.supercast.com. SUPERCAST.com. And please don't forget to rate and review. Every rating counts. Thanks so much.